Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, January 17th, 2014. It's the Federal News Countdown every Friday at the 4 o'clock hour. Two experts from the world of the federal government choose the news stories from this week that they think are the most important to people who work for the federal government. And this week, my guests, back on the countdown, Lee Doherty of Fluitt, Huber & Wong, and thank you very much for being on the program, as always.
Always a pleasure, Francis.
Good to see you, my friend. And Jim Williams, who has a new gig to plug, don't you, my friend?
I do. It is Schambach & Williams Consulting, LLC. Just started.
And you and Pat Schambach are doing that, too. How did he get his name first on the sign there?
It's alphabetical. He's a great guy, and we didn't care. We're just two people who have known each other for a long time, a lot of federal service, care about the government, thought we could come together and help customers.
I wish you every success with that, Jim, and appreciate you being on the program today. You've each chosen three terrific news stories on this week's countdown, and we start where we always do with
number three.
Lee, your third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is DHS has lent border drones hundreds of times. One of the first things that we saw when the discussion about domestic drones came about was, how do we know, we being citizens or people who are observing this, when state and local authorities are going out and buying their own drones? I don't think anybody stopped to figure that they just bum them off the federal government for a little while.
That's right, and that's what we see here in a FOIA request that was litigated by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a civil liberties group. Through that FOIA, determined that Homeland Security, Borders and Customs had lent drones nearly 700 times in the past 3 years to various state and local agencies, not all of which were released as part of the FOIA.
And that's the interesting thing here, is that there's no indication where these went, who was using them, or what they were using them for. This story says records don't list which sheriff's offices or local law enforcement agencies were able to use the drones. This is kind of a Wild West still, the whole issue of drone usage. I mean, it's possible that if somebody wanted to go get one, they could get their own. You could get a drone and fly it over my backyard and see what I was doing. You wouldn't find anything very exciting. But you could do it, because we're still at a very, very early stage of the policy issue here. What do you see when you look at this story from a legal perspective, Lee?
Well, it's interesting. Many of these legal issues, although we talk about me flying a drone over your house, and I would venture to bet there's even less interesting things in my backyard than yours. But really what we're concerned with is the government flying these drones over our houses and what access the government has. Most of these legal issues, from a constitutional standpoint, your right to privacy, where your expectations of privacy end, those are fairly well resolved. The Supreme Court and other courts throughout the history of our country has defined those things fairly well. What I find interesting here is the access of agencies that in the past would never have access to aerial surveillance suddenly have access to these. One, they're available. Now we see they're available. You don't have to have the money to own one. You can just go borrow one for a little while. And as this FOIA indicated, we don't know how many hours were flown. We don't know where they were flown. We don't know if a court authorized the surveillance that was done by these agencies. So I think there's a lot of questions to be answered here. But again, just the mere accessibility of government agencies that in the past would never have had these available to them is a little disconcerting to the public, I think.
Jennifer Lynch, a staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said the government declined to provide the names of local police agencies using the drones because of concerns that such information could interfere with ongoing investigations. And my first thought when I read that, Lee, was, well, certainly some of those investigations have been completed, and so we could receive information about those investigations, I would think. Am I wrong there?
Well, no, you're not wrong at all. And in sort of typical bureaucratic doublespeak, what we have here is saying, an agency saying, look at all the wonderful things we've done. We've been able to go in and provide disaster relief. We've done these other things. And then quietly say, yeah, there's these ongoing surveillance. This is using to gather intel or investigations against citizens. But we don't want to talk about that. We don't want to provide information on that. Even as you indicate, the investigations that perhaps have concluded. Now you said earlier, we're real early in this policy. And as recently as a couple of weeks ago, the FAA announced these six test sites for how to incorporate drones into the commercial space, and But what we're dealing here is this idea of the government intervention into our private lives.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Lee Doherty as DHS has lent border drones hundreds of times. And you can read it later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Jim Williams, along the same lines, actually, your third most important federal news story of the week is from Politico. Obama revamps U.S. surveillance. And this is a story President Obama just giving this speech today. And again, it's the what the government's looking at as far as what you and I as private citizens are doing really is at the core of this story, Jim.
Well, I was struck as you and Lee were talking that it really is the same thing. It's the availability of newer advanced technology to collect information on people's private lives. And I think what the president said today, and I listened to his speech, I thought he did a great job, first of all, of acknowledging the work of all of these federal workers who really do jobs where they can't talk about what they do, but they're dedicated to protecting this country. But I think what people look at, maybe a lot like Lee's, is, well, the government's saying, trust us, we're doing something good, you don't need to know about it. And that means it's really a one-sided discussion. And I think by putting in people like privacy advocates, making it more transparent where you can, then it makes it more open and allows for both sides of an issue, both the security and the privacy side, to be weighed as they should be.
It's a difficult balance to walk, Jim, because I understand the hesitancy of the average citizen who's concerned about privacy, because the government claims, well, we're collecting this information, we're preventing terrorist attacks, we're preventing incidents. And so the response of the average citizen who's concerned about privacy is, well, can you give us an example? And the response is, no, we can't, because it would give information to the bad guys. And those are valid concerns on both sides. I mean, you certainly know from your experience at DHS that information in the wrong hands can do tremendous damage.
Absolutely. And as the president said, there are people who want to hurt us. There are threats, whether they're physical, cybersecurity, there are threats and people who want to do great damage to us. But I think, as people have said, our openness is both a strength and a weakness. And I think that we are the only country that I understand that actually self-limits our spying. And the president even, you know, took a little bit of a jab today at Russia and China and these other countries who feigned all of their surprise at what we do.
Shocked.
When in fact,
shocked
that there's spying going on here. When in fact, almost every nation does that. And the United States has quite a bit of restrictions in place. But I think the president, again, I thought he did a great job today of reflecting the balance, what you needed to do to appropriately protect this country, but also to protect our civil liberties. And the changes, I think, you know, it's yet to be seen does Congress accept these changes, but I think all of them are going to make the American people feel better about what we're doing.
Jim Williams' third most important federal news story of the week is from Politico. The headline, Obama revamps U.S. surveillance, and you can read it and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Jim Williams and Lee Doherty. We'll continue the countdown in just a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. It's the Federal News Countdown every Friday in the 4 o'clock hour. The three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Jim Williams and Lee Doherty, we're up to
number two.
And Lee, I have to confess that your second most important federal news story of the week, I'm not sure I see. Most of the time, I have a pretty good idea where people are headed. This story is from the Washington Post. The headline is American whiskey maker Beam to be acquired by Japan's Suntory. It's a big deal in the liquor business. How does this fit into the federal landscape?
Well, I thought this was interesting for today, especially because January 17th, 1919 was a day that national prohibition went into effect. So here we are, this anniversary of the advent of prohibition, and out comes this story, and personally I've done my share to increase the value of the of this company over
the
years.
That's why I thought that was my first thought was.
But no, on a more serious note, what struck me by this is the and I think it sort of relates to both Jim and I's first story, this globalization of the world of the American brand, and we have this fantastic brand, but it's been globalized. And so I did a little research, and I thought, well, here we are, Jim, being this old Tennessee whiskey being bought by a Japanese company. What other companies are out there? I think we're all familiar with Smithfield Ham, the original Virginia ham,
yes,
being bought by a Chinese company. But mm-hmm. Budweiser is now Belgian-owned. Miller Beer is South African-owned. Holiday Inn is British-owned. Firestone Tires, that great Indy 500 tire company, is Japanese-owned. Gerber Products is Swiss-owned. 7-Eleven is Japanese-owned. So we see this globalization of American commerce. And I think what any time you have such a dramatic, as we see this dramatic impact on global commerce, it's going to affect us on a federal level. And so I look at this and I'm fascinated by this idea of globalization. You mentioned earlier the Chinese being shocked that we would that we would spy on them, and yet here we have a number of very prominent U.S. companies being bought by the Chinese.
I think it's really fascinating that the Japanese, in addition to the Chinese, well, the Japanese have been interested in American brands and buying American products for decades. But it's just been within, I would say, the last 10 to 15 years that they have really set about actually acquiring the companies themselves. Mm-hmm. And it was surprising to see this story, Jim, that Jim Beam, Maker's Mark are the two companies here. I didn't even know they were owned by the same company, to tell you the truth. I perceived them to be different brands, but that they're on the way to becoming Japanese. What did you see when you read this other than get thirsty?
Well, I guess I was wondering the rationale behind it as well. But I do remember hearing about this week. And again, like Lee's saying, it is the globalization of American brands. And, you know, what's next? Does somebody buy Disneyland or McDonald's or something? And, you know, what is truly an American brand anymore? And I think it's starting to fade. I do think there are always still concerns, even when you look at the latest spending bill, still concerns in the bill about China mm-hmm. and Chinese computer-made products. So I think there will still be concerns about who's buying what. I saw this at DHS many years ago when I guess it was – who was somebody's trying to actually buy a port, and I think it was Dubai. And,
yes.
And Congress was outraged.
Yep.
Said you didn't follow the what's called the CFIUS process when I think it actually was. And they overlooked that China was actually, you know, practically owned one of our other ports.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're going to have to get used to this, that it's going to become, as Lee said, it's a globalization kind of everything.
Right. And the point about prohibition, I think, is interesting because it was 95 years ago, and obviously it didn't really work. It's instructive to think about that in light of what we're seeing in Colorado and some of the other states that are thinking about marijuana legalization.
Well, it's funny Jim brought up McDonald's because Burger King is owned by a Brazilian company. Hellmann's and Heinz are both owned by foreign companies, so you can't get a condiment in this country that is actually owned by an American company. So, but when you think about spending going forward, government spending, we hear often, especially on the DOD side, the you know, that the Chinese are sort of are the enemy that's out there looming, mm-hmm. and yet we see that they own AMC theaters. They're so integrated into our culture and our economy that I think it begs the debate of how much of an enemy can they truly be when they're so when we're so codependent in a global marketplace. So again, I think that's interesting, and I think this is going to be a bigger story in the coming years as we become more global.
Well, and I think if you don't mind me adding, as that translates into an integrated global supply chain and people want to try and police that supply chain, it becomes a lot harder if the federal government wants to say, okay, we want to know everything about your supply chain to make sure it's secure. They could potentially add enormous costs because you're talking about integrating or policing supply chains that are literally all over the world.
Does that mean, though, that there are potential openings for companies that want to come into that marketplace that are based in the United States and can certify their supply chains here in the United States, and they can do it in a, maybe a smaller, more nimble way?
I think that's to be seen whether Congress and others will go so far as to put in those kinds of restrictions to say that it can only be produced in this country, because I think that's kind of a false sense of security, because you can produce something in this country and have it totally produced in an American factory and somebody can still put malware into it. And as you know, a lot of the threats are insider threats, and it's not necessarily, you know, the attacks, the cyber attacks, don't all come from China and Russia. A lot of them come from right here in the good old USA.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Lee Doherty, is headlined American Whiskey Maker Beam to be acquired by Japan's Suntory. It's from the Washington Post, and it's linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Jim, your second most important story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is What You Need to Know About the New Internet Rules. And the story starts, a federal court on Tuesday overthrew federal rules to enforce what's known as network neutrality. This is something that's gone back and forth, and there's been legislation to try to address this and a number of other things. What strikes you about this is so important this week?
Well, first of all, Francis, I believe the Internet is something that touches everything, the Internet of everything, and certainly it's something that is important to everybody's daily life. And whenever anybody tries to make a change about the Internet, it has the possibility of having a gigantic impact. What struck me also was this is so controversial. Whether you try and put in this network neutrality, as the FCC has been trying to do, to say that all Internet traffic should be treated the same, free and equal, and you have people on both sides of these issues. And even though there was a ruling by the, I think it was D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the Verizon case this Tuesday that said kind of striking down network internet neutrality, it's network neutrality, it's not going to stop there, because there's so many people who are so heated on both sides that think this is going to be very bad for consumers. And I think the consumer type organization is going to rise up and say this is bad. But on the other hand, people on the other side of the issue who oppose network neutrality believe this is going to stifle innovation. You're trying to regulate something that the reason why the Internet is so good today is because nobody tried to regulate it early on. And in fact, it's possible that the court here gave the FCC an out to say the only reason we struck you down is because you didn't go back in 2002 and classify these Internet service providers as common carriers. Then you could have legitimately regulated them. You didn't do that. You called them information providers as opposed to telecommunications services companies. So I think this battle is not over. And much like the other things, I think this may be a pendulum swinging back and forth, where somewhere there is going to be Congress looking at and others saying we've got to put in the proper protections. Otherwise, the Internet becomes something that's maybe catered to the elite, where you can charge more and there'll be different tiers of service, and that may be looked upon as not fair.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a story that's going to continue, and whether the FCC tries to go back and reclassify these ISPs, Internet Service Providers, as common carriers, which you know Verizon will come back and fight that again,
mm-hmm.
because they really believe that if you let it be less regulated, more innovation will come.
Is this really, Lee, an innovation question in your mind, or is this just about the money and the access?
I think it's about it's primarily about the money. If you read it and read what their arguments were, it really is let us self-regulate. Let capitalism also permeate the Internet. Mm-hmm. So if someone is willing to pay us for faster service, we should be allowed to charge to provide that faster service. Now, unfortunately, from an information and access to information standpoint, that means those that can't afford that faster access maybe are limited or even denied access. So we we run the risk of having not government censorship, but actually sort of this capitalistic driven censorship based on who can afford access. The story uses the analogy of a driveway to your house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who can afford to get into that driveway? And so I understand from a business standpoint what Verizon and Comcast and the other litigants in the case are arguing, but it worries me that I'm not going to be able to get on my internet and I have Verizon and get information because that particular website just can't afford Verizon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the wrinkle here is that this case is directed at companies that do business over the internet rather than individuals. You know, if I want to go and get faster service, I can do it, or I can decide not to and take the slower service. This article uses the example of Netflix and describes it that if the internet provider that I use could charge Netflix more money for me for providing that service to me, well, obviously Netflix is going to have to pass that on to me. They're not just going to eat that. And that's the reason I wondered if this is really an access money issue more than an innovation issue. Jim Williams' second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is What You Need to Know About the New Internet Rules. And it, along with all of our stories on the countdown, linked up later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news stories of the week are next on this week's Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Jim Williams and Lee Doherty, and we're up to
number one.
And Lee, your choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Federal Contracts Plunge, Squeezing Private Companies. And my colleague Jason Miller reported on this also this week. The outgoing OFPP Administrator Joe Jordan talking about the fact that the government is buying less stuff, products and services. And the implication I took from the headline of this story was that it's causing some problems for the companies that do business with the government. You work with these companies on a daily basis. Is it your sense that there is a squeeze on here?
I'm not sure that squeeze is the right word. That wouldn't be how I would describe it. But there's definitely, and you and I have talked on this show many times about over the course of the last couple of years about the changes that we're going through. There's definitely, especially from the smaller companies, the competition is increasing. The ability to get sort of the low-hanging fruit. There isn't any low-hanging fruit. So while I wouldn't say that there's a squeeze on, I would say that companies are going to have to change the way they do business with the federal government. They want to stay competitive.
What do you this is right up your alley, Jim. This is right in your wheelhouse. And it actually is similar, again, to your choice for the most important story of the week, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But I thought that the headline, I read through the story, and I thought the headline was the most interesting thing out of it, just that there's a perception that broadly across the federal contracting space, companies are really feeling a very tight pinch. And they give some anecdotal stories through the course of this news story from the New York Times. But I think I'm having a hard time seeing the really tight vice-like squeeze that's implied in this story, Jim.
Well, I think if you read the story right in the middle of it, it talks about the largest decline is in military spending related to Iraq and Afghanistan, the overseas contingency operations, which is kind of the peace dividend. But I think when you go to the next story about the spending bill, there's the cutbacks in DOD and the sequestration. Well, the sequestration, a lot of that is going to be changed. So I think this is where the trend was going in 2013. I think it may be different in 2014. I think there was also, early on in this administration, there was a lot of focus on insourcing, and that seemed to take away some of the traditional work that federal suppliers did. And I think that has been backed off, and at the same time trying to put in better practices to manage contractors. So I'm not sure that this plunge is a trend that's going to continue.
Well, the idea, too, that I see throughout this story is that there are the implication I take away from it is that the federal government's responsible for the success or failure of the companies that are discussed in this story and for the broader contracting community at large. And yet, the message that I hear from administration officials, not just this administration, but from people who worked in the Bush administration, procurement, and so on, is, hey, it's up to the companies to succeed or fail and to be experts at knowing what they need to do, as you said, Lee, serving the customer. The story quotes Dan Gordon, and Dan has sat in the seat you're sitting in right now and said that very thing, Lee. Right. So it's a little puzzling to me that somehow it's the government's responsibility to keep spending in order to keep these companies in business. Am I seeing something in this story, do you think, that's maybe not there? Am I reading too much into it?
No, I think what you're reading is the perception that many people that I deal with on a daily basis, and especially those that are in the smaller and medium-sized companies, I have to continually remind them that they need to do the same things in business that those in the commercial space have to do. They have to go out and market themselves. They have to invest in their infrastructure. They have to create ways to be more competitive. And those days of again, the low-hanging fruit doesn't exist. And let me give you a few numbers. I'll throw a few numbers at you real quick. If you think about the increase that we've seen over the last decade in government spending, and starting in 2007 when we were only spending $207 billion, and we saw this rapid increase, in part, I think, driven by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we saw in 2009, we reached the peak of $550 million. So in that nine-year period, we went from $200 billion to $550 billion. Then we had a slight drop-off and leveling out until the last 2 years, where we went from $535 to 516, and now, as this story indicates, last year at 460. So 460 is still a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And as I encourage my clients, there's still a lot of money to be made. And I know you and I have talked about, and I've said on this radio show more than once, that in my opinion, there's in order to be successful in government contracting, you either do what no one else does, or you do what other people do, and you do it better and cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's simply the way to be successful. And so I don't think you're seeing anything that's not there. In fact, in the article, Dan Gordon even says he predicts that the federal government spending will continue to decline. And I would agree with him. I think we're going to see this trend, maybe not to the extent that it was this year, but I think we're going to see it continue decline in spending on government contracts.
There's a quote in this story, Jim, that I think really gets at the crux of what Lee's talking about. It quotes Eric DeMarco, chief executive of Kratos Defense and Security Solutions, talking about his company's contracts going down. But he says the thinning of the budget will ultimately be good for Kratos, which is based in San Diego. Agencies will favor firms, he believes, that can deliver innovative products for reduced prices. And he says this: I'm going to figure out how to deliver that widget for $20. There is some good here as well as pain. And he's getting at what Lee is talking about, which is there's still plenty of room for companies who do something really well, who do something nobody else does, or who, as Lee said, can do it better and cheaper. They're still going to be very successful in this market, it seems to me. Is that a reasonable place to be?
I think it is reasonable. I think I agree with Lee. I think there's still going to be a lot of money out there. And I think the focus on costs, I think, is something that is happening. I think there's also a potential for a backlash. The government goes too far. And a lot of people who've been in this industry a long time look at the government going to lowest price technically acceptable because it's safe, and they don't go to what is truly the best value, which can lower cost over time, lower risk to programs. And I think, you know, if you're going to succeed in federal government contracting, you've got to also know the missions of these agencies. You've got to not only deliver something innovatively, but at a great price, but you've also got to be somebody who the federal agency believes that you understand their mission and you know how to help them succeed, because so many times there's a lot of work that's being done that is complex, that involves risk. And I think the government is going to have a turnaround where they stop simply focusing so solely on cost. Not that it's not a bad thing to focus on cost, but to the exclusion of quality, it almost always is.
Lee Doherty's most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Federal Contracts Plunge, Squeezing Private Companies. You can read it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Back for Jim Williams' most important federal news story of the week to wrap up this week's federal news countdown next on In Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. It's the Federal News Countdown with the three most important federal news stories of the week, selected this week by Lee Doherty and Jim Williams. And Jim, your most important federal news story of the week is from USA Today. Senate passes $1 trillion spending bill. It is headed to President Obama's desk. It means that we will not have a shutdown or anything else to worry about in those regard, for the rest of this fiscal year. That's September 30th. We already have a top line number in place for fiscal 2015. And theoretically, a lot of people seem to think we could actually go back to real budget bills starting this year. We haven't seen that in Washington for like 10 years or something like that.
Well, I think this is a good thing from one perspective, that it actually is stability, where agencies now know, and hopefully for 2 years, here's how much money generally we're going to get. And these agencies, you know, last time we talked, I think it was in the midst of the shutdown and all of the nonsense and the dysfunctional government, and I'll put in both sides of it here. Now, all of a sudden, we get a budget deal through the Ryan Murray Pact, and then we quickly get out a nearly 1,600-page omnibus spending bill for all the discretionary spending. That quickly, and I think it's the specter of the midterm elections, and it always reminded me of the phrase, speaking of contractors, the floors are always cleanest when the janitorial contract's up for renewal. And you're at the pressure of not wanting the specter of this kind of government dysfunction hanging over their head as they go into midterm elections. They got something done. And I think that's a good thing for the agencies, that they won't have to keep this replanning. I think it is interesting that it looks like the spending, some of the sequester cuts have been erased. So, you know, we still have this little thing, $17 trillion deficit that we have to deal with. So this was about a third of the budget. The rest of it is the entitlement. So when do we start attacking the actual deficit? But I think this is, on balance, this is very good news. The president, I'm sure, will sign this bill, and everybody will sing kumbaya.
The President Obama had asked Congress on a number of occasions in the past week or so to sign this or to pass this. So every indication is that he will do so at the earliest opportunity. I think, Lee, it's great to be out of the shutdown business. It's been good for us at Federal News Radio and our colleagues and competitors in the federal media, but it's certainly no fun for the people that are listening to this program and have to live with this every day. So I think it's really monumental to be out of that business. What do you think about this?
I would sort of go along with what Jim says, that the timing, and in this article that Jim is presented here, it quotes Senator McCain calling it a shameful way to do business to be presented with a 1,600-page bill and less than 2 days to actually review it. And so I would agree with you. It's fantastic to have that. You and I have talked on this show a few times about the feeling of uncertainty,
yes,
both at the federal employees as well as contractors. And this is great because it takes some of that uncertainty away. People can start planning their business and planning their year with much more consistency. But as a consumer and as a taxpayer and a citizen, I'm reminded of the Obamacare bill that went through very quickly that no one seemed to have read until after it was passed and the problem started. And I'm at least somewhat concerned here for the same reason, that the same concern that Senator McCain brings up. This is a lot. This was a big decision that seemed to have gone through very quickly with very little fanfare. And That worries me a little bit. Maybe it shouldn't. I'm not sure, but it does worry me.
No, I can understand that, and I think that worry is warranted. It strikes me, though, that given where we were, you know, even as recently as 3 months ago, to come to this point isn't great, but it seems to me we're on a track that's similar to somebody that's recovering from the flu. You don't feel great for a while, but you understand you're headed to something better. And the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, Hal Rogers, is quoted in this story saying he intends to return to regular order this year. The story says with the goal of approving the 12 bills individually and by the September 30th deadline. And, Jim, if they're able to do that, yes, this wasn't the best way to go, but maybe it was the step that was needed at this point in time to get back to where we need to be. I mean,
I think
maybe I'm a Pollyanna, but that's kind of how I've been trying to look at this.
I agree with you, Francis. I think that's part of the hope for future going forward, exactly what Chairman Rogers has said. And I used to deal with Chairman Rogers, have a lot of respect for him, and him saying, look, we want to get this place back to where we all would like it to be, where we pass regular spending bills and we do it on time and do it, as Lee was saying, with a more deliberative process than a few days and several hundred pages slipped through.
Because now that this is cleared out of the way, there's pressure here on the members that I don't know if they feel or not. I think there's pressure there because this is out of the way now. The past couple of years, we've been going through the CR process where the business at hand was yesterday, essentially. You know, the budget to cover the government for the next 10 minutes. Now they're out of that business. They're good now until September 30th. So the focus then becomes, what do you do next? And they can concentrate on that. And now there's no excuse because they can't say, well, we had all this other stuff that was most so important. This is the most important thing now is going back to regular order. Well, it seems to me.
Again, that's where I started. The good news part of this is the stability. You know, when we were here last time, you know, constantly saying we're going to, as an agency, have to replan, because we don't know how much money we have. I mean, that drives agencies crazy. It's a lot of money being spent and wasted doing that. It drives the contractor community crazy. So now that we have some stability, maybe we can actually make some accurate projections about what are the priorities given this amount of money. Where are we going to spend the money and actually do even procurements better?
And as agencies are able to do procurements better and able to do more, Lee, you're going to see a big uptick in business, I would think, because there's just more going on. We've been in kind of this holding pattern for the last, especially the last 3 or 4 months is what agencies are telling me. And I'm hearing kind of the same thing from vendors. But the sense is that once this happens, the time between, say, the minute the president signs it and, like, the beginning of summer could really be gangbusters for the contracting community.
Well, and the nice thing will be that we're going back to again, being able to plan your business, be able to get in those business development pipelines and start doing real proposal writing again and knowing agencies will know what their budget is without having to constantly be trying to scrape money together, trying to figure out if they can fund something. They're constantly modifying contracts to cancel CLINs because that money just isn't there any longer. And so it'll be fantastic. I think you'll definitely have a much more, as Jim says, stability within the community. And the other thing I think is interesting is, this has been the fight for the last year. We shut our government down over this, and yet here the government has shown that they have the ability to find compromise, find middle ground, resolve what is the biggest issue. So there's very little excuse not for them not to deal with some of the other issues that are on their plate right now, which I think both from on the federal side here in this town and throughout the country, as well as for the citizens in general, our expectations that they can do this now. Mm-hmm. They can compromise. They can work together. And and perhaps they've buried the hatchet in some way and they're able to move forward.
Well, one piece of incentive that might be there, too, is a sense that I'm starting to get from the political scientists that I read, and that is that the coming midterm election may not be as much about ideology as it is about competence. And the reason that Congress's approval ratings are so low is because the people that are polled are of the opinion of they can't do anything, and they're not discerning about the parties as much as they used to be, as far as who's responsible for nothing happening. They just know nothing's happening. And so it strikes me that that might be behind this, all of it. You said, Jim, it's felt like all of a sudden they were getting this done when just a couple of months ago we were in shutdown mode. And I wonder if that might be where that's coming from.
Well, I think that pressure to avoid the embarrassment of the shutdown, as you said, Francis and Lee, it hurt all of them. It was not Democrat or Republican. It was collectively, you guys can't get it done. And somebody said, at the time, we should have lined them all up like the Three Stooges and slapped them all at once and say, do what you were elected to do, which is find compromises that reflect the will of the people and pass these kinds of things that are part of your duties.
I think this is the first time in the 3+ years that I've done the Federal News Countdown that we've had a Three Stooges reference. So I congratulate you for that, Jim, and appreciate that. And it's a terrific way to close out this week's Federal News Countdown. The most important federal news story of the week, selected by Jim Williams, is from USA Today. Senate passes $1 trillion spending bill. Thank you, gentlemen, for being on the program.